What I want to discuss today is a set of ideas. You want me to get this closer? This is a pretty small room. Do I really need this thing? All right. The noisy room, too. A set of ideas which are correct in economics but lead to incorrect policy conclusions. All human societies face what economists refer to as the coordination problem. In order to do almost anything, you need to somehow coordinate the activities of very large numbers of people. Famous example is making a pencil. If you work it out carefully, making a pencil requires several million people because the pencil needs wood, the wood needs lumber, the lumber needs chainsaws, the chainsaws need steel and gasoline and copper and a bunch of other things, trace it all the way back, and somehow you have to have some way of getting people to make enough, to mine enough coal, to make enough steel, to make enough chainsaws, to cut the amount of wood you need for the number of pencils you need. That's a simple way of thinking of it. And there are two different ways of solving this problem, one of which doesn't work. The way that doesn't work is the obvious one, and that is you have somebody at the top giving instructions. Somebody calculates, we need this much coal mined, you people go mine the coal. We need this much iron ore, you people go mine the iron ore. It works for very small groups, if you think about a football team or a small business. It doesn't scale, which is basically why the Soviet Union collapsed. The method that does work is some decentralized arrangement in which somehow each person does a small part of the problem and they coordinate. And the standard one of those that we're familiar with is the way in which markets work. So if you can only set it up so that when I make my decision, the net costs to everybody are equal to the costs to me, the net benefits to me, then my interest will be the same as our interest. And the first approximation, that's how a market works. That if I want to produce something, I have to buy my input. To buy my inputs, I've got to pay people for their labor or their stuff enough so they're willing to give it to me, which means that the cost of using those inputs is transferred from them to me. When I produce an output, I sell it to other people for the value to them of what I'm producing, which means the benefit of what I'm doing is transferred to me. So that means that I'm receiving the net benefit of my actions. And if I'm receiving the net benefit of my actions, and everybody else is, then each of us has the right incentive. It's a lovely system, but it has problems. And it's the problems that I want to talk about. And the problems occur because we don't really have a way of dividing up the world such that my actions only affect me and those people who have agreed to interact with me and not anybody else. So when I manufacture steel, I have to pay my workers for their time. I have to pay the people who mine the coal for their coal, but I don't have to pay the people downwind for the sulfur dioxide that I'm putting in the air they breathe. That's what economists refer to as an externality. So the problem is that if my actions are producing a negative externality, it may pay me to take an action even though it on net makes us worse off. It may pay me to produce more steel than would be worth producing if we allowed for that extra cost. Similarly, if my actions produce a positive externality, a benefit I can't collect, then I have an incentive to underproduce, to produce less of whatever it is I'm producing. That's the problem. And there are basically four solutions to that problem. None of them work perfectly, but they work to some extent. Again, the obvious solution is the one that's simplest to central planning. That's the regulatory solution. You have some government agency that says, this firm is allowed to produce steel here. We've decided that firm, the pollution does too much damage, so you can't. We've decided that cars produce pollution, which can be reduced with catalytic converters, so all cars must have catalytic converters. That's sort of, in a sense, the obvious solution is to have some wise and benevolent person deciding what people ought to do, not in all details, but with regard to these externality problems. There are a lot of problems with that solution, because to do it, the wise and benevolent person has to know a lot of things he probably doesn't know. He has to know how much it costs to reduce pollution from any particular firm, how much damage is done, and so forth. There's an alternative solution, which is more popular with economists, was thought up by an economist called Fagu a little less than a century ago. And that solution is to price the externality. So you say to the steel firm, you can put up as much sulfur dioxide as you like, but we have calculated that every ton of sulfur dioxide you put up does about $3,000 worth of damage to the people downwind, so we are going to charge you $3,000 per ton for your sulfur dioxide. And that has the advantage over direct regulation that the steel firm, which does know how easily it can reduce its pollution, has an incentive to do so. That the steel firm then says to itself, if we can reduce pollution at a cost of less than $3,000 a ton, we should do it. If it costs more, too bad, steel's going to be a bit more expensive. They also have an incentive to include the cost of pollution in the cost of the steel they sell, which means that the people downstream are allowing for that cost in their decision of how much steel to use. But it still has the problem that the people setting it have to know what the externality is. They have to know what the costs are in place. Third solution, which was associated with an economist called Ronald Coase, a good deal later than Pigou, is for the parties involved to bargain. And the argument is that if the steel firm has the right to put out the sulfur dioxide, but the people downwind can go to the steel firm and say, look, we'll pay you to agree to put on filters on your smokestack or to use low sulfur coal because that raises the value of our land. So that's a case where bargaining by the parties is producing the outcome. And that has the advantage that the people who are making the offer are the ones who bear the cost, so they know what their cost is. The steel firm knows the cost of reducing the pollution. So in principle, that takes care of the information problems on both ends. The problem with that is transaction cost, as Coase pointed out when he raised this issue a long time ago, that if you're talking about one steel firm and five people downwind, it probably works. But if you're talking about one steel firm and a million people downwind, now each of those people downwind knows that if he offers to pay the steel firm, his contribution will affect almost nothing, whereas any benefit will be shared with a million other people. So the Coasean solution is a workable solution in the context where transaction costs are low, but it's not a workable solution if you're trying to control air pollution in Los Angeles. You aren't going to get 6 million people in the L.A. metropolitan area bargaining with 3 million car drivers in the area in order to get them to put catalytic converters on their cars. And the final solution to externality problems is the one we use much of the time, which is to do nothing. That after all, if I go to the trouble to dress particularly nicely, I'm providing a positive externality for everybody who sees me, but we don't actually have any legal rules to make me do it. We've got some social customs that may help. If I repaint my house, I'm providing a positive externality for my neighbors, similarly, or if I mow my lawn. Those are all possibilities. And the policy implication that's normally drawn for this is that if you have an action that imposes negative externalities, you tax it. That's the Pigouvian tax. If you have one that provides positive externalities, you subsidize it. And that's an economically correct argument, provided you're considering a case where transaction costs are high. The problem is that it gets applied to cases where we don't really know what the externality is. And the case of this that I first ran into is something I wrote about 45 years ago with population. That back in the 60s and early 70s, the orthodoxy that everybody believed was that overpopulation was a terrible threat, and that if you had another child, the result was to make the world as a whole poorer. And the predictions that were made out of that belief were that terrible things would happen unless people did something to cut down population growth. The extreme version of that was a book confidently predicting that there would be mass famine in the 1970s, with hundreds of millions of people starving, that it was too late to prevent that, and all you could do is to decide which hundreds of millions would starve. I got involved in that argument. I was asked by the head of the Population Council, a private organization, to write a discussion of population issues from a pro-free market standpoint, because all of the discussions were being written from the other side. And so I tried a very simple calculation. I tried to add up all of the effects on other people of a family having one more child in order to decide whether the net effect was positive or negative. And I couldn't do it. That if you think about that problem, the positive accounts are, if I have another child, he might find a cure for cancer. If I have another child, that's one more person sharing the tax burden for paying the national debt. If I have another child, he might write a novel people enjoy. He might make a scientific discovery. On the other hand, if I may have another child, he might go on welfare. He might become a criminal. He might burn logs in his fireplace and make the air less pleasant for other people. So I tried to estimate all of those things and concluded that I could not find the sum. I could not tell whether the actual net effect was positive or negative. And I think this is a general problem when you're talking about issues like population or global warming, where there are both positive and negative effects, and those effects occur over a long and uncertain future. What matters, after all, is not whether there are any externalities, but whether there are net externalities. If I take an action and it provides a $1,000 cost to you and a $1,000 benefit to her, then I have the right incentive in terms of total cost and benefits to everybody. So the case that I got into more recently, for the last 10 years or so, I've been arguing with people about, is global warming. And it has struck me for a long time that the people criticizing the orthodoxy are attacking the wrong part of it. That people who criticize the orthodox view of global warming try to argue that warming isn't happening or that it's not due to human action. As far as I can tell, the evidence that global temperatures are trending up is pretty good. It's not certain that the reason is human action, but it seems like the most likely guess. The physics of the greenhouse effect are basically correct. We know the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has gone up. So it seems quite likely that a large part of the reason temperatures are trending up is because we're putting CO2 in the atmosphere. The weak part of the argument is the claim that this change is clearly going to have bad effects. That I want to claim that we in fact do not know. I assume for a moment, for my purposes, I don't want to argue the climate science, so I simply assume that the IPCC estimates are roughly correct. And the IPCC estimates, if you look at the last version of them, suggest that on the high emission scenario, the scenario which assumes that CO2 emissions keep going up with economic growth, on that scenario, the global temperature by the end of the century will be about 3 degrees centigrade higher, and sea level will be something in the range of 2 feet to 3 feet higher. Roughly about a meter is the high end of the range for their projection. And the question is, what are the effects of doing this? And there are basically two ways you can try to answer that question. One of them is to say, a priori, what would we expect the effects to be? Is there a reason to think that raising the temperature of the globe by about 3 degrees will make us on net worse off? And the argument for that is not very strong, that the present climate of the world was not designed for us, nor were we designed for it. Over the period our species has evolved, the climate of the Earth has varied quite a lot. We've had half a mile of ice over the current location of Chicago, for example, and London. If you believe that the world was designed for us, I'm an atheist, so I don't, but if you believe that, then you should also believe that God arranged for global warming, and therefore there's no particular reason to worry for it. But I think the more plausible belief is that the climate across the world happens to be what it is, we happen to be what we are, there is no reason to think that we've hit it exactly right. And that's supported by the fact that, after all, human beings currently live across a wide range of different climates. The way I like to put it is that if the IPCC is right, by the end of the century, Minnesota will be as hot as Iowa now is. I haven't observed any catastrophes in Iowa due to its temperature. So there's no particular a priori reason from that standpoint. There is, however, one a priori argument for warming being bad, which is also an argument for cooling being bad. And that is that we are currently optimized against our current environment. So where we build houses depends in part on how high the sea is. What crops the farmer grows depends in part on what he expects the weather to be like for the next few years. So to the extent that we're currently doing things in the way designed to fit the current environment, any change at all has negative effects. That would be a strong argument if you were talking about rapid change. If you imagine the sea level rising by a couple of meters in a couple of years, that would cause an awful lot of flooding. But we're actually talking about very, very slow effects. The total sea level rise over the last century is, I think, about 8 inches. It's projected to be faster than that over the next century, but you're still talking at the very upper edge of the IPCC estimate, depending on the high emissions assumption, which I don't think is very plausible, you're talking about a meter of sea level rise. The rule of thumb for the U.S. Atlantic coast is that a meter of sea level rise shifts the coastline in by about 100 meters. So if you think about a map, shifting the coastline in by 100 meters is an invisibly small effect on the map. All right, 100 meters is less than 1/10 of a mile. Furthermore, building a 1 meter high dike is not a huge construction project. There are, I think, the lowest city in the Netherlands is something like 9 meters below sea level at present, and they're dry. So the change in sea level is a very slow change, and therefore one which can largely be adapted to by saying, all right, next time I build a house on the beach, I'm going to build it a few hundred feet farther inland. Similarly, with regard to crops, that farmers in fact change the variety they are growing routinely, every, 5 or 10 years as new crop varieties come out. If temperature is going up by a few tenths of a degree a decade, which is about what the figures suggest, they aren't going to have to change very fast. And when they bring in a new variety of crops, one of the things they'll take advantage of is temperatures are a little bit warmer than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So I think there is an argument that change is bad, but it's not a very strong argument for change as slow as this is likely to be. So one way of doing is say, is there any reason to expect warming to be bad? The other is to try to do what I did with populations many years ago, to say, all right, here is a positive effect, how big it is, here is a negative effect, how big is it, add them all up. And if you actually try to look at them, it is hard to do, and it's not at all clear what the result is. So that it is true that global warming will... What? Yes? Sure. Yeah, the answer is that we have some data going back long before humanity, because there are ice cores from Greenland and from Antarctica in which you've got ways of measuring what the temperature and CO2 concentration was back then. Yeah. I don't know which lost cities where you're thinking about, but there are, I don't know. But in any case, nobody argues that CO2 is the only thing affecting temperature. The claim is that the CO2 is the one thing that's changed a lot in the last 200 years, and that therefore we know that temperatures have gone up and down for other reasons in the past. I think that's very unlikely to be the case. Remember that the biological processes, you are taking CO2 out of the air to make plant material and then putting it back in the air when we or an animal eats it and breathes it out. So that's not increasing the net CO2. And what's happening with what we're doing is you're taking CO2 that was turned into plant material, was turned into coal and oil, and then putting that back up. So if I can continue for a moment. So sea level rise means that you're going to lose a small amount of very valuable real estate, because in general coastal real estate tends to be valuable. There are a few places in the world where it's going to be a big effect. If you look, there's a wonderful web page that lets you see the effect of any level of sea level rise. And it turns out that the Nile Delta is very vulnerable. That quite a lot of people in the Nile Delta are going to have to move if sea level goes up by a meter or two. Most of the world, that's not the case. On the other hand, if you think about it, human land use at present is limited by cold, not by heat. The equator is populated and the poles are not. So if temperatures go up, temperature contours move towards the poles. Whatever the place that was a certain temperature in the past, now the place that temperature is 100 miles farther north, in the northern hemisphere. I've tried to do a very rough calculation, and I don't know if anyone has done a more careful one, but my estimate is that the gain in usable land from warming the cold parts of the Earth is about 100 to 1,000 times as large as the loss from sea level rise. Now, it's going to be less valuable land. It's not coastal land. I doubt it's 1,000 times less valuable. But that's one example where you have positive and negative effects. Another is a point that is routinely made and is probably true, is that with global warming, the hottest summers get hotter. And very hot summers kill people. And that's almost certainly true. On the other hand, with global warming, the coldest winters get warmer too, get milder, and cold winters kill people as well. There was actually an article sometime back in The Lancet, the British medical journal, which tried to estimate globally total deaths from heat versus total deaths from cold. And their conclusion was that total deaths from cold were nearly 20 times as large as total deaths from heat. Now, we don't know how fast that changes as you make winters milder or as you make summers hotter. So that certainly doesn't prove that the net effect is a benefit, but it at least suggests it. There's another effect, another reason which is really part of the physics that suggests that net effect might be benefit. And that is that if you work out the physics of global warming, of the greenhouse effect, it turns out that it tends to be larger in cold times and cold places than in hot times and hot places. So if the effect of the greenhouse effect is that summers get a degree hotter, it's probably that winters get a degree and a half warmer. The numbers would depend. Similarly, it means that if the hottest parts of the Earth go up by a degree, the coldest parts may go up by 2 degrees. Again, I'm making up numbers, but the quantitative argument, if people are curious, I can explain the physics of it, is that the effect tends to be larger in a cold environment than a hot environment. And that's a bias in our favor, because on the whole, warmth is a good thing when it's cold and a bad thing when it's hot. There's another effect which gets discussed a little bit, and that's CO2 fertilization. That CO2 is an input to photosynthesis, and people have known for a long time that increasing the CO2 increases plant yield. And in fact, greenhouses quite routinely pump CO2 in for that purpose. And the rough figure, there, it turns out there are two kinds of plants defined by the way they do photosynthesis, referred to as C3 and C4. C3 is the more common pathway, and most major crops are C3 plants. The big exceptions are sugar cane and maize, corn. But the other major crops are C3. The rough numbers are that if you double CO2 concentration, which is roughly what the IPCC projects for the end of the century, C3 plants increase yield by about 30%. So that's a whopping big increase in total food supply. C4 plants also increase yields, but by not as much, and that's the net effect there is not as clear. It also turns out that when you increase CO2, plants need less water than before, because the water they're losing is losing as air goes through the leaves. And if the CO2 concentration is higher, they don't need to pass as much air through the leaves in order to get the amount of carbon that they need for making vegetable matter. So the net result is that CO2 fertilization is a big positive. There are a bunch of quite uncertain effects. That for a while, the IPCC was claiming that global warming was increasing drought. And this was, of course, a popular theme in California over the last few years. The latest IPCC report, they retracted that claim. They said that there was not good evidence so far that warming was increasing droughts, or the droughts were increasing. Part of the problem, of course, part of the reason it's easy to see what you expect to see, is that weather varies for a lot of different reasons all of the time, so if you think something is making it worse, you just notice the bad part. Similarly, there have been arguments about increased hurricanes. And there again, it's quite unclear that we can discuss the physics if people are curious, but the physics of hurricanes turn out to be quite complicated. It's not clear. A few years back, one of the people who had written the Atlantic hurricane section of the previous IPCC report resigned in protest, because the person who was going to be in charge of the hurricane section of the next report had publicly claimed that increased hurricanes were the result of global warming, when, according to the person who resigned, there was no peer-reviewed science that supported that claim. And he has a webpage somewhere, and his opinion is that on theoretical grounds, our best guess is that global warming will make hurricanes a little bit more powerful and a little bit less frequent. But we aren't really sure about that, and I think that probably is about right. Flooding, the basic argument is that there are projections that rainstorms will get heavier, and that could cause more flooding, which would have costs. But the basic point that I want to argue is not that global warming will produce net benefits. It might, but I don't think we know enough. It is that when you're looking at effects over a long period of time with both positive and negative effects, you don't know if the net effect is positive or negative. And then what ends up happening in both the population and the global warming case is if you start out expecting it to be negative, or if you want it to be negative because you want to argue for policies on other grounds that would make sense if it was negative, then when you're looking at costs and benefits, you make generous estimates for the cost, you make conservative estimates for the benefits, or you don't notice the benefits because you're not looking for them, and then the result of all of that is you say, aha, there's a big negative externality, so of course we should have cap and trade or carbon tax or something like that. I think that's what happened in this case, and I think, as I say, it's a mistake for critics to focus on the climate science, because I think the real weak argument is the claim that if the climate science is right, the results will be bad. Let me give you one example that happened to strike me a few years ago. And this involves an economist who has been one of the people who's tried to estimate effects of global warming. And he had a book up on the web, I'm not sure if it was a published version or a draft, that he co-authored. And very roughly what that book said was, if you look at only confidently predictable effects of global warming, it's a wet firecracker. And if you look at the results we're reasonably sure of, he didn't think it was positive, but it's not negative enough to be a serious issue. But he said, you also have to look at low probability, high cost effects. You have to say, what if there's only a 5% chance of this catastrophe happening, and only a 3% chance of that catastrophe? You ought to add up all of those too, and that's right, you should. What struck Andy said, he then tried to estimate those, and that was clearly very, very, very uncertain. He was going to different experts and saying, how likely is it you think this catastrophe would happen? But it never occurred to him to ask whether there were low probability, high cost consequences to stopping global warming. All right? There's one very, very obvious one. People talk about ice ages. We are currently in an ice age. We have been in an ice age for about 3 million years. The technical definition of an ice age is a time when there is ice on one or both of the poles. All right? Within an ice age, you have what are referred to as glaciations and interglacial periods. The glaciation is what people often think of as an ice age. That's when you have half a mile of ice over Chicago. The interglacial periods are what we're now living in. The periods in between glaciations, when you still have ice on the poles, but you don't have ice going nearly as far down from the poles as during a glaciation. We don't really know why glaciations happen or why interglacials end. Since interglacial has been going for a long time. It is quite unlikely, but not impossible, that the reason the glaciers are not moving towards the equator at the moment is anthropogenic global warming. It is possible that it is our influence on the climate that is preventing the next glaciation. I don't think it's very likely. But what he was looking for were low probability, high cost effects. I can assure you that the effects of dropping sea levels by a couple of hundred feet, which is the effect of a glaciation, and freezing, I'm not quite sure how far, but well past Chicago, maybe as far as Vegas, is larger than any of the likely effects from global warming. So that would be one example where I don't think he was being dishonest. But what you're looking for is going to affect what you're finding. And if he's trying to find reasons why warming is bad, which there's a good deal of pressure on him to do, he's not likely to look very hard for reasons why it's good. Now, my basic conclusion then is that in cases like this, what you almost always should really do is to wait. That over time you get more information. As you have more information, that puts you in a better opportunity both to estimate the climate science, to see if they're overestimating or underestimating the sea level rise and the temperature increase, and at the same time to look better at the effects, to what extent is temperature increase having that bad effect. One further point on this, and that is that there are problems not only with individual incentives and coordination, but with government incentives. And in the very simplest form, one reason why preventing global warming is a very hard thing to do is that the problem of individual costs and benefits not matching social costs and benefits applies for nations as well as for individuals. That if global warming has net costs, those are probably net costs for countries located in hot parts of the world, and may well be net benefits for countries located in cold parts of the world. There was a different one of the economists who looked at this, more or less the only one who was somewhat skeptical, who at one point had an article with a map of Europe, and he had a line across that Europe, that map, which represented his current estimate. Above this line, global warming benefits, below it hurts. Well, in that situation, it is very hard to get governments to do what is in some sense on a world level the right thing, because the ones that benefit aren't going to want to. And even ones that are harmed by global warming, if my country takes the hit of using expensive renewable power instead of cheap fossil fuel, the benefit is shared with a whole bunch of other countries. So if the cost is $1 billion and the benefit is $2 billion, the benefit to us is probably much less than $1 billion, so it doesn't pay us to do it. One of the advantages of the strategy of adapting to global warming instead of trying to stop it is that adaption is more nearly a private good. If a farmer shifts crops, he's the one who benefits. If a city dikes against sea level rise, it is that city that benefits, not the whole world that benefits. So it's easier to do it. The other advantage to adapting rather than trying to prevent global warming is that if you adapt, you get to keep the benefit while at least minimizing the cost. You get to keep the advantages of crop increase from increased CO2 while reducing the flooding by building dikes or shifting where your buildings are or things of that sort. so I think from that standpoint, there are real advantages. There, the argument for what is the current orthodoxy, namely that we should do expensive things to hold down global warming, is probably wrong. And I'm not sure how long I'm supposed to talk, so let me stop at this point and take questions, or else just quit if I'm supposed to quit. Thank you.
And if anyone, I don't think people have their hands raised, so if anyone has questions answered, we'll pass the mic, and we can direct it out to Stephen Short.
What? I don't know anything about the effects of aerosol spraying. Sorry. I'm sorry, I don't know anything at all about the effects of aerosol spraying. There are many things I don't know, just like everybody else. Yeah. I think what you're describing is one of the many things where it is very hard to predict the actual effects. That these are complicated systems, they might make things worse. There's an argument which suggests that the Gulf Stream would stop doing what it's now doing, and that Iceland would actually start being a less pleasant place to live than it now is, but I don't think we really know. I think what you're really... Go back to my initial point that the present climate was not designed for us or us for it. So random changes are presumptively bad only to the extent that we have already optimized against the present environment. So in what you're describing happening, presumably you would have more people living in Siberia and fewer people, that is, and fewer people living in, I don't know, Western Europe or Iceland or someplace. But I think those are all random effects. And I don't think you have a ground for saying you expect the net sum of all such random effects to be negative or positive. I just don't think you know. Oh, there's somebody there. Part of the reason that I think the high emission scenario is quite unlikely, that the IPCC publishes results for a number of alternative assumptions about CO2 emissions, and the one that's always quoted is the high one, and that one assumes continued economic growth, and that economic growth being a proportional increase in CO2 output, and I don't think that's very likely for two different reasons. One of them is that renewables are a relatively new technology. They're therefore likely to get better over time and therefore become more competitive with fossil fuel. And the other is that fossil fuel, as people keep on pointing out, is a depletable resource. The more oil you pull out, the harder you've got to look for more oil, ditto for coal. So although it's not clear what the totals are, and of course technology can also reduce that, but that's an old technology, so less likely to. So my guess would be that fossil fuels are likely to trend up, renewables are likely, and nuclear, and if we're lucky, thermonuclear are likely to go down. So that would be one reason. But more generally than that, the most recent nonfiction book I published a few years ago was called Future Imperfect. And what it was an attempt to look at technological revolutions that might happen over the next few decades. And I gave a talk on it at Google. And I started the talk by saying that I really thought global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe, that I had three different ways of wiping out the human race faster than that. In the sense that I think the future is very uncertain, that there are technological changes that could mean that in 100 years there are no humans left. There are technological changes that could mean that in 100 years global warming is the kind of problem that can be dealt with by the pocket change of one very rich person. That is, there are technological developments that can make us a great deal richer and more powerful, that can destroy us and everything in between. So I think the uncertainty is very large there, and I think it is rarely worth doing anything about a problem a century in the future, because we just don't know enough. The only exception I can think of is if we project an asteroid to hit Earth 110 years in the future. It's probably worth trying to do something about it soon, because we actually have good enough physics to make that kind of prediction. And although it's possible in 110 years we'll have some way of destroying asteroids, that's a hard problem, so I wouldn't count on it. Yeah, right. Thank you.